Now we have time for questions. How are things going today after all this?
I think I can say something about how it went a year or so after, and that will be my focus. We reduced calls significantly. We changed the way people behave on the website and how many people go to get their answers in the self-service. Also quite significantly. and we changed a lot in the behavior in the telephone too. We used this along with a lot of other data and a lot of co-listening too to change the way we set up the telephone channel. We made a split so we could visitate the calls from customers and non-customers. We knew with this and with a co-listening building on the same principle, the same categories. We categorized a lot of qualitative calls. Took the same categories and found the typical questions in each category. And we used this to set up the telephone call in a way where we could give the primary answers in the telephone. So we had a lot of people calling and putting back on and leaving the phone before anybody talking to them.
So the number of telephone calls have been reduced after
yes.
this.
Yes.
Has that resulted in savings? In Ubetal in Denmark,
well, or
better, or better quality for your clients.
I think both.
Yeah.
Every call costs, so it's every call is money. Yeah.
Do you have an estimate? Is it marginal or is it big?
I cannot share it here.
Okay. But is it you have to give an idea. Is it significant or is it
it's
just
significant?
It's
yeah.
Okay. That's hey. Thank you very much. That's all I needed. Okay. Thank you very much so far, Mette. Does that make any remarks? I would like to ask you at the panel and perhaps you, Peterson. Is there a and Chris and Sarah as well? Does this, when it's implemented, is there an idea of whether it gives you a big savings, or is it better quality for the organization, or actually is it somewhat a bit of both, or don't you have any idea? You have to. Yeah.
I have to press it. Shall I say something?
Go for it.
Okay, fantastic. I think it depends. I think it depends on the one hand what you want to achieve as an organization, because I was working with the UWV in the Netherlands, which is the public employment service in the Netherlands, about 8 years ago, and it was in the middle of the economic crisis, and they were faced with the situation that out of the blue their budget was cut in half, so they were forced to just save money and do things more efficiently. So they had a really strong driver to, push people online, push them away from in-person communication, and reduce the number of phone calls simply to save money.
They had
because there was no money. Because
they had a burning platform, so to speak.
Yeah,
yes.
But so they had a reason to do so, and their primary goal was simply to, save money. Was that smart? No, it probably wasn't, because in 2016 they found out that there were a lot of complaints and a lot of mistakes were being made, so they sort of came back on the strategy, but they didn't have a choice. It is my personal belief that you should probably do a little bit of both. I think it's legitimate for especially public organizations to work as efficiently as possible, simply because you're spending the citizens' money, and you want to do that responsibly and efficiently. At the same time, you need to help people as as good as you can. So if you're able to save money and you use some of that money to give back to the taxpayer, but use another bit of that money to help the people that need it, I think you're doing a good job.
Christian, Sarah, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, well, we did, and we actually had a presentation here, 2-3 years ago, about a study we did that was very, very specific surrounding the single parents declaration. And that led to a 40% reduction in calls. And also citizens that were more satisfied. So in that instance, we did manage to combine, and that was also a huge effort and a group effort and a lot of work, but in that instance, we did manage to combine economic savings with better service quality. But that's not necessarily always something that goes hand in hand, but in certain instances, and you mentioned the word burning platform, then it might be possible. But not always. But there are instances where, thankfully, it is possible.
So,
absolutely.
So if you push it too hard, it can perhaps give savings, but the result is not...
In their case, it did backfire because, you know, on the one hand, you get a backlog of people that are in trouble, but you're not dealing with that, and at some point in time, that's going to explode. They also had a lot of political fallout where the ombudsman in the Netherlands started complaining about this and, you know, ministers had to go and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So there was a lot of turmoil in different areas.
Sarah, I'd like to, because we have a number of Norwegians in the audience as well. Is there a difference between Norway and Denmark on this issue? Is it more difficult in Norway or is it easier? Or do you have an idea of that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've been in Norway since 1 year, and I think there are differences, especially since Denmark has this mandatory e-government use. So there's always the electronic channel kind of involved. I don't know exactly about the situation in Norway. Maybe the Norwegian delegates can say something about that.
Yeah, we have a microphone there. Please, and list your name, stand up and say your name and where you come from.
Hi, Ragnhild. I work in NAV, as mentioned before here, and I have some colleagues here with me. Some of us made the drawing that you showed, it's based on a lot of interviews with co-workers and users. And it's when we talked to Christian for the first time, he was in Norway, and we almost couldn't believe how similar it was. So we are here now to talk to you about, your research. Could I also ask some questions while I have
sure.
the... Yeah. First, we see the same thing, that they still use more traditional channels, of course. I wonder, do you see historically if the questions in more traditional channels have changed as we develop more digital services? That's one. And the second is, one of the main findings we have is that people need to feel secure and to have trust. And it sounds soft, but it's so important to succeed with the channel strategy. And it seems that people experience it more when they call us and talk to us. But when they go online, they're alone. And still they need to feel secure because some of the payments are giving you the food you need to survive. So if you have any reflections on that, how we can... We need to try to give that in every channel.
Yeah. Christian?
Thank you for coming, first of all. The first question, we actually discussed that yesterday concerning the transition in the kind of questions asked, and I haven't seen, I don't know of any data that exists on that. Maybe there is some in ATP because they have been doing pensions for a number of years, so maybe there would be something there. I would assume that there's been a change in the kind of questions as we are transitioning towards digital channels. I would assume that the questions that now arise concern the digital digital journey, but I have no empirical basis to sort of test that assumption on. So that I think that's the first one. And then as for the, I think the trust issue is vital for many areas. But I think we need, and Sarah said this also, we need to consider the service area in question, right? If I'm returning a library book, okay, that's not the end of the world. But if, like you say, I don't get food on my table, that is the end of the world, and it's the end of my children's world, right? So I think trust matters a lot, and I think it matters for specific services more than others. I did another study for the thesis where we found that the people that use digital channels were more likely to trust the public authorities, whereas those that use traditional channels were less likely. And the reason for that, this was a qualitative study, and what they explained to me was that they want to sort of tease out of the caseworker if there was insecurity there and if there was more to ask about, right? So if the caseworker sounded uncertain on the phone, they know they could keep asking questions to dig in. Is there more that... Do I have access to more benefits, for instance? And there's also this negotiation issue that we also see. And then there were other citizens that said, no, they trusted completely in the system. They believed that they would get everything they were entitled to. To them, it didn't matter which channel they used because it was an objective system in their worldview. Yeah. And then we had those that believed it was a subjective system, open for interpretation, and they would go towards the traditional channels. But these were just qualitative insights, so it would be interesting to see if we could scale that up with a survey. I don't know if...
Willem, do you have any idea of the trust and distrust and perhaps whether it has changed over time from country to country?
I don't know about the latter. I did a large survey in the Netherlands last year for the Ministry of the Interior on service quality and the things that people find important when getting services from government. And we had a list of, 20 or so different aspects of service delivery, such as, accessibility of information and ease of use and ease of understanding, but also things related to security and trust, such as, trust in government, how important it is to you, and security of your information and privacy protection. And we found that of those 20 or so things that we had, all those things related to trust and security were at the very bottom of the list of importance of people. And then we had a series of focus groups with people, and we asked them, why is that? Because we assumed that they would be far more important. And the feedback we got was, we do find them important, but we see those as baseline conditions.
Right.
That needs to be okay. It needs to be well. I assume my privacy is going to be protected, and that needs to be in place. Whether I like service delivery depends on, the design of the thing and how easy it is to use it. But trust is so important, that's a basic thing, and it just needs to be in place. Right.
Okay, we have a couple of questions. First there, if you stand up and say your name.
Yes, hello, Bo Damsted from the engineering company COWI. Thanks for, fantastic study and sharing the lessons learned. Thanks a lot for that. It's really inspiring. I think as a practitioner, there was two things that really caught my interest. One thing is, of course, the longer-term impact of this new learning, because I completely agree that there's a lot of things still to learn. I think ATP shared a little bit, and of course the internal time spent on communicating with citizens and customers takes up a lot of time, but I think more importantly, their perception of the improved quality of the communication and the information given, is that an impact that you are following, or do you in your study also see the long-term improvements caused by the lessons learned from this study? That's the key one question. And secondly, on the limitations, the GDPR, actually looking into some of these data sources, what are the limitations you see moving forward on this still new area?
Who would like to comment on that?
Well, as for the first question, and that concerned the evolution of what was happening, I don't think we have the data to say anything about that yet. Maybe we will get additional data in the future so we can. But for my part, I'm no longer a postdoc at ATP. I'm an assistant professor here, so I don't have access to that. That's the short, boring answer, really. As for the GDPR, I can't really tell you very much about that either, I'm afraid. This was a study that was undertaken in 2017, I believe. It was undertaken with the support of the legal department and so on and so forth. So I hope we will be able to do things like this in the future. I think it's vital that we have access to these insights, but if we can, we have such good registry-based data in Denmark. That's one of the also actually the foundation of our entire digitization, right? Is the registry base that we have. So I hope we can continue doing this. But yeah, I'm not a lawyer, so
I can say a few things about the GDPR in the context of the project that I was telling about in the Netherlands, where we're building this cloud-based data environment where we're logging, you know, a really big amount of things about customer contacts and customer interactions. First, a little disclaimer. GDPR is very important. We need to protect privacy. I fully understand and commit to the GDPR. Having that said, we have so much data that we could use to say something about things like customer journeys and cross-channel behaviors and multiplex channel behaviors that I simply cannot do because of GDPR. Because when I want to use the data that we have for analysis purposes, I need to, you know, depersonify them. So all PII needs to be removed, making it really hard to say something about groups or even individuals of people, making it virtually impossible to figure out whether citizen A has been online. So things I can do right now is I can, based on an IP address, which is going to be hashed into a unique location ID, so not the actual IP address, I can say that somebody in Guatemala has been looking on the Dutch consular website and looking for information about a visa. And then if 5 minutes later I have a phone call coming in from Guatemala about a visa, I can probably guesstimate that that's the same person. Mm. But that's about as far as I can get. And of course, as a researcher, I'd love to go much further. And this is where GDPR, sadly, is limiting the things that we can do.
It's like when someone is saying, I'm not a racist, but then we really have to listen to this. I'm sorry. I couldn't help it. We have a question up there as well. And we're short of time, so make it brief, please.
Yeah, my name is Søren Lausen. I used to be a professor here. And one of my professions is to design good user interfaces that people can figure out to use and help them solve their problem. And I've been teaching that for more than 10 years here until the course was abandoned somehow. And when we design a user interface, we try to test it with real users and try to see whether they can figure out to use it. It's called a usability test. And whenever you find something that people cannot figure out, we call it a usability problem. And we try to repair them. I have seen here wonderful examples today of usability problems. Some of them cannot be dealt with electronic media, need personal contact, but a lot of the things can be repaired in that way. One of my star students designed in 2009, I think, a user interface for the maternity benefit. Her design is on my website. She describes how she did it. She tested it with mothers, fathers, of course, but also municipalities and employers. And her design consisted of one single screen with a number of tab sheets on it. And it supported everything, also mothers with two fathers for the same baby, or with seven employers who all had to get benefit. She did that and tested it and showed it to KMD at that point in time. They were developing their system. And they looked at it and said, how have you made that? How long time have you spent? Well, she said, half a year, what the thesis is. They had been working 20 people for 2 years trying to develop the maternity benefit system. And they had not designed a single screen at that point in time that had to be added later. So for me to see this, I want to cry. No, I don't want to cry, but I cry. Because it's so miserable. You can't design much, much better systems. It's not hard, but we don't teach it. And somehow we assume we cannot change the systems very much. We can't do a lot here.
Okay. Thank you for that comment. I would like because we are short of time right now. I would like to start or to end with the main character of today, and that's you, Mette, actually, believe it or not. And I would like you to stand up and because this strategy, it's all these organizations up here represented from Denmark and Norway also. It's not everybody that have some researchers going in and make a case study and work together with them and helping you to implement. So basically, this journey you have been on, has it been difficult or was it easy?
It's been fun.
That was not the question.
No, I know. It's been difficult in the way that we didn't know how to grasp it at the beginning. So it's been a lot of kind of bubbles emerging together in this process. And it's been easy in the way that the solutions were not that difficult to make when you saw them. And it's been easy in the way that we cooperated with the caseworkers and the manager of the maternity leave department. It was very non-bureaucratic. a lot of kind of decisions that didn't need that much, you know, all that paper around it. Yeah. So in that way, it was.
Okay. So it's somewhat like Nike, just do it, or what? Is that the conclusion, Willem?
I would say yes. I mean, you have to do these things. The problem is, though, that we have to do a lot of things, so it doesn't make it necessarily easy.
I think that was the conclusion on this afternoon. Before we make a big applause to all three, I would like to make just a practical thing in Danish. Vil jeg sige, at næste arrangement i regi af Forskningscenteret for Offentlig IT, det er den 19. marts, som jeg har lovet at reklamere for. Der er nemlig besøg af en forsker fra, blandt andet en besøg af en forsker fra den absolute verdenselite inden for projektledelse Oxford, professor Bent Flyvbjerg. Og der er altså mere på itu.dk, og så under fanen arrangementer, der kan man se mere om det. Men altså den 19. marts, så snyd ikke jer selv for det, hvis I har interesse og mulighed for det. Lige om lidt, så er der forfriskninger udenfor, og hvor man kan netværke og bytte visitkort, og hvad man nu ellers har lyst til. Og lige om lidt, så kan I tænde for jeres mobiltelefon igen. Men inden I gør det, så giv en stor hånd til de tre deltagere.